Reading from Startide Rising by David Brin, Chapter 81, Charles Dart. Early in the morning, he was at his console at the water's edge, happily conversing with his new robot. It was already down a kilometer, planting tiny detectors in the drill tree shaft wall along the way. Charles Dart mumbled cheerfully. In a few hours, he would have it down as deep as the old one, the next to worthless probe he had abandoned. Then, after a few more tests to verify his theories about local crustal formations, he could start finding out about bigger questions, like what Kithrup the planet was like. Nobody, but nobody, could stop him now. He remembered the years he had spent in California, in Chile, in Italy, studying earthquakes as they happened, working with some of the greatest minds in geophysical science. It had been exciting. Still, after a few years, he had begun to realize that something was wrong. He had been admitted into all the right professional societies. His papers were greeted with both high praise and occasional vehement rejection, both reactions far preferred by any decent scientist over yawns. There was no lack of prestigious job offers. But there came a time when he suddenly wondered where the students were. Why didn't graduate students seek him out as an advisor? He saw his colleagues besieged by eager applicants for research assistantships. Yet in spite of his list of publications, his widely known and controversial theories, only the second-raters came to him, the students searching more for grant support than a mentor. None of the bright young males and femmes sought him out as an academic patron. Of course, there had been a couple of minor cases in which his temper had gotten the better of him, and one or two of his students had departed acrimoniously, but that couldn't account for the doldrums in the pedagogical side of his career, could it? Slowly he came to think that it must be something else, something racial. Dart had always held himself aloof from the uplift obsession of many chimps, either the fastidious respectfulness of the majority toward humans, or the sulking resentfulness of a small but vocal minority. A couple of years ago, he began paying attention, however. Soon he had a theory. The students were avoiding him because he was a chimpanzee. It had stunned him. For 3 solid months, he dropped everything to study the problem. He read the protocols governing humanity's parenthood over his race and grew outraged over the ultimate authority mankind held over his species. Until, that is, he read about uplift practice in the galaxy at large. Then he learned that no other patron gave a 400-year-old client race seats on its high councils, as mankind did. Charles Dart was confused, but then he thought about that word gave. He read about humanity's age-old racial struggles. Had it really been less than half a millennium since humans contrived gigantic, fatuous lies about each other simply because of pigment shades, and killed millions because they believed their own lies? He learned a new word, tokenism, and felt a burning shame. That was when he volunteered for a deep space mission, determined not to return without proof of his academic prowess, his skill as a scientist on a par with any human. Alas, that he had been assigned to Streaker, a ship filled with squeaking dolphins and water. To top it off, that smugpot Ignacio Metz immediately started treating him like another of his unfinished experimental half-breeds. He'd learned to live with that. He cozied up with Metz. He would bear anything until the results from Kithrup were announced. Then they'll stand up. As Charles Dart enters rooms, the bright young human students will come to him. They'll all see that he, at least, was no token. Charlie's deep thoughts were interrupted by sounds from the forest nearby. He hurriedly slapped the cover plate over a set of controls in a lower corner of his console. He was taking no chances with anyone finding out about the secret part of his experiment. Denny Sudman and Toshio Iwashika emerged from the village trail, talking in low voices, carrying small bundles. Charlie busied himself with detailed commands to the robot, but cast a surreptitious eye toward the humans, wondering if they suspected anything. But no, they were too much into each other, touching, caressing, murmuring. Charlie snorted under his breath at the human preoccupation with sex, day in, day out. But he grinned and waved when they glanced his way. "They don't suspect a thing," he congratulated himself as they waved back, then turned to their own concerns. "How lucky for me they're in love."
"I still want to stay. What if Jillian's wrong? What if Takata Jim finishes converting the bombs early?"
Toshio shrugged.
"I still have something he needs."
He glanced down at the second of two sleds in the pool, the one that had belonged to Tom Orley.
"Takata Jim won't take off without it."
"Exactly!"
Denny was emphatic.
"He'd need that radio, or the Edies would blast him to bits before he could negotiate. But you'll be all alone. That fin is dangerous."
"That's just one of many reasons I'm sending you away right now."
"Is this the big macho Mel talking?"
Denny tried sarcasm, but was unable to put much bite into it.
"No." Toshio shook his head. "This is your military commander talking, and that's that.
Now let's get these last samples loaded. I'll escort you and Sahat a few miles before we say goodbye." He bent over to pick up one of the parcels, but before he touched it, he felt a hand in the small of his back. A sharp push threw him off balance, flailing.
"Denny!"
He caught a glimpse of her, grinning devilishly. At the last moment, his left hand darted out and caught hers. Her laughter turned into a shriek as he dragged her after him into the water. They came up, spluttering between the sleds. Denny cried out in triumph as she grabbed the top of his head with both hands and dunked him. Then she leapt half out of the water as something goosed her from behind.
"Toshio!" she accused.
"That wasn't me." He caught his breath and backed out of arm's reach. "It must have been your other lover."
Oh, no! Sahat!"
Denny whirled around, searching and kicking, then whooped as something got her from behind again.
"Do you scrotum-brained males ever think of anything else?"
A mottled gray dolphin's head broached the surface nearby. The breather wrapped over his blowmouth only muted his chattering laughter slightly.
"Long before humans rode out on logs, we made an invention. Care to manage a try at ménage à trois?"
He leered, and Toshio had to laugh as Denny blushed. That only set her splashing water at him until he swam over and pinned her arms against one of the sleds. To stop her imprecations, he kissed her. Her lips bore the desperate tang of Kithroop as she kissed him back. Sahat sidled up alongside them and nibbled their legs softly with jagged, sharp teeth.
"You know we're not supposed to expose ourselves to this stuff if we can help it," Toshio told her as they held each other. "You shouldn't have done that."
Denny shook her head, then buried her face in his shoulder to hide it.
"Who are we fooling, Tosh?" she mumbled. "Why worry about slow metal poisoning? We'll be dead long before our gums start to turn blue."
"Oh, Denny, that's nuts."
He tried to find words to comfort her, but found that all he could do was hold her close as the dolphin wrapped himself around them both. A comm buzzed. Sahat went over to switch on the unit on Orley's sled. It was the one connected by monofilament cable to Streaker's old position. He listened to a brief burst of primitive clicks,
then squawked quickly in reply. He rose high in the water, popping his breather loose. "It's for you, Toshio." Toshio didn't bother asking if it was important. Over that line it had to be. Gently he disengaged from Danny. "You finish packing. I'll be back right away to help." She nodded, rubbing her eyes. "Stay with her for a while, will you, Sahat?" he asked as he swam over to the comm unit. The Stenos shook his head. "I will gladly, Toshio. It's my turn to amuse the lady anyway. Unfortunately, you need me here to translate." Toshio looked at him uncomprehendingly. "It is the captain," Sahat informed him. "Kraideki wants to talk to both of us. Then he wants us to help him get in touch with the techno-inhabitants of this world." "Kraideki? Calling here? But Jillian said he was missing." Toshio's brow furrowed as Sahat's sentence sunk in. "Techno. He wants to talk to the Kikwi?" Sahat grinned. "No, sir. They hardly qualify, fearless military leader. Our captain wants to talk with my voices. He wants to talk to those who dwell below."